We said 1:30, so I guess let's...
Remember to turn the light on, or turn the light on the phone here. All right, let's get going. Well, we've had a very interesting morning. We've had an opportunity to hear from Mayor B, cap and trade, many other things. We've had a good overview from Jim Karas as to the way in which the district regulates refineries currently and how what the degrees of freedom are in the setting of those. Now it comes for us to deliberate, to talk a little bit. And I'm not going to put any particular constraints on this other than to say we have till about 2:30. So we got a good hour here to see where this conversation goes. I would, I think there's a whole lot of issues that that for me come to mind. I'm an air quality guy. I'm a health risk person. So I tend to put everything in terms of public health. How do we protect the public health of people who live in the Bay Area, and how do the choices that that we need to make come back to that? Could we have the slide number 5, please? That's worth looking at this one and maybe keeping it up here during our discussion. This is the question we've been asked. Yeah, one more. There you go. What is the efficacy of imposing numeric caps on greenhouse gas emissions from Bay Area refineries? Refinery caps, yes or no? Make it simple. Yes or no? Shades of gray, maybe. Eventually, that's where we're going to have to get. That's the question we've been asked, and that's the question we're going to answer. Not today, but
so
at
it,
some
it
point
isn't
soon.
Toxics and it isn't the criteria air pollution and toxics. It's only greenhouse gases.
Well,
because we got some indication that, sorry.
I think it comes back. Yeah, well, that's.
From Richard Corey said it was, they were worried about toxics.
Well, it sounded like from what Richard was saying, if I understood what he was saying, that there are different tools to do different things. There are tools, there's cap and trade is one tool to deal with greenhouse gases. Local rules, which have, I believe, their basis in public health protection, that are the way to address toxics, risks from toxics and criteria pollutants. So that's an interesting way to look at it. There are different tools to do different things, but you need to know what it is you're trying to do, protect the public health. And that's not to say that greenhouse gas reductions don't have a huge effect. They just have it over a longer period of time. And whereas toxics and certainly criteria pollutants have their effects almost immediately. I mean, it could be breathed particles today and become sick or die.
I guess I understand that, but I was just... questioning the question. Is that the question we're asked to answer, or is it all emissions?
I don't think you can put it in without putting it in context of the others. I mean, it's all part, and we're trying to regulate the effects in this case, refineries and public health. So to me, it'd be hard to separate them out. But in the context of concerns over toxics and criteria pollutants, what about this? This introduces for me a lot of things that have to do with economics. I mean, this is fundamentally there's some really critical important questions. Spatial scale too. I mean, do I really care whether a ton of greenhouse gases are reduced in here in the Bay Area? Per the discussion we were having earlier about what a large fraction of the local greenhouse gas emissions they are. Or in Carson, in Southern California. I mean, it's a one world as far as greenhouse gases are concerned, at least at first order. Actually, I'm getting far into a lot of the issues that I know all of you want to get into, so I should stop doing that. So let me just open this up and let's just see where this goes.
So just to respond to Jane's question, I think it's good for us to talk about this point to make sure we're on the same page and clear. My sense of this question is there's already programs to address toxics and criteria pollutants, and more probably will be done on those fronts. And the question before us is, in addition to those things, currently in place and maybe additional steps that will be taken on criteria pollutants and toxics, in addition, you know, should we also be recommending specific rules that target greenhouse gases from these specific sources in this specific geographic area? So it's not that the others aren't an issue. It's that they're already being addressed through existing programs or new regulations to there. And the question is really, should we add this to what's already being done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So first, I guess I want to say, it sounds like at the next meeting, we're going to have advocates of the caps and the refiners, who I presume are not advocates of the caps. And so I am open to hearing what they have to say. I think where I am right now, which I've done a public in the Energy Institute's blog, I've written about the state policies, and I think the arguments apply even more to a local area, that the idea that we should be addressing greenhouse gas or climate change by this narrow focus on hitting a specific target for greenhouse gas emissions in a very narrow area, I think is not really the best approach. I would much rather see approaches that figure out how to create technologies that more broadly address greenhouse gases, which I think California has policies in that area as well. But so sort of set that as a premise, I think there is also a real issue both with the crowding out, although if we're at the price floor, the state and the state cap isn't binding, then it's not clear that we're just crowding it. We're just being replaced somewhere else in the state. But also with how you would run a cap of this sort. So the question is caps, not cap and trade. If you either have to be able to do this as a tradable cap, and I think the market would just be way too small to operate in any credible way. I think California's is borderline, and a Bay Area cap would have a very small number of participants who would be so large relative to the market that you really wouldn't have a credible price. And what you're actually accomplishing with cap. And I guess I would want to hear, what's the goal of having a Bay Area specific cap? Is it just so that we can say we've done our share? In which case, I think you need to really evaluate what we've done, that is how much leakage there is, and whether this is just getting replaced somewhere else, in which case we're just patting ourselves on the back. Or whether we have some other goal in mind. And one of those might be co-pollutants. But I think if we're going to go down that road, we have to have a discussion of, is that really the right way to address co-pollutants? Are we already addressing co-pollutants with other policies? So at this point, I don't really see what the positive story on our justification is, but obviously there are people who do see it, and I think it would behoove us to hear them present their own arguments as much as
sure.
But I think there it would be useful to sort of lay out these questions. California is 1% of world greenhouse gas emissions. Bay Area refineries are a very small share of that. What is it that imposing strict limits on Bay Area refineries is going to accomplish that is worth the potential costs? And then what are the potential costs in terms of economic activity, in terms of sort of productive efficiency, and so forth? The reason the refineries are all here is because it's an area where there is good transportation access. And if they start refining somewhere else, it's quite possible that you actually increase total energy use and emissions because you're actually running a less efficient refining system.
But I think one of the places where I'm totally ignorant is that there are many places within the refinery scheme where there could be technology improvements, and perhaps we should think of this in terms of what can we do to identify areas where improvements could be made, and then later on deliberate whether, if we put a cap on, would that help stimulate, or would be there be some way of incentivizing an improvement of the process? And what goes on here could then be translated to other parts of the state, other parts of the country.
And our experience, though, with that, you know, with a lot of other technologies, I think, is that caps or technology mandates of things that don't exist yet are sort of a high-risk business. Sometimes they have pushed producers to actually create new technologies, and other times we've just rolled back the standards because they weren't achievable. I think in some ways the argument for caps on greenhouse gases is weaker than the argument for regulating ambient air pollutants, which are, it actually lowers costs to not have to worry about ambient air pollutants, to just spew stuff. Whereas greenhouse gases are associated with heat waste of some sort, and they actually have some incentive to become more efficient in that direction. They would argue they have plenty of incentive. That's not true, because they aren't also taking into account the externality from the greenhouse gases. But if we put a price, and I would argue that if anything were going to be done, a price, I'm not sure whether it's legally doable, but a price makes a lot more sense than a cap. But if we put a price, even the current federal government estimates of $40 a ton, which I doubt is politically viable, but let's say we could do that, would that change refinery behavior very much? And that's an interesting question. And maybe it would sort of push the technological development that could then be exported. But when you think about the fluctuations we've had in crude prices and the incentives that's brought about, and the fluctuations we've had in refinery utilization and incentives that's brought about, even $40 a ton, I suspect, is a fairly small increment to their costs. But that's what I'd want to know.
And I think Alberta has done something along these lines. I think it's aimed more at the upstream oil business, but it would be useful to get the particulars of that and how it's working, trying to tax the upstream carbon content of the fuel, so trying to push the market towards lighter, sweeter crudes that are easier to refine and easier to produce. So in that question, I mean, I think one of the things I heard today that seems to me to the hole in the regulatory system right now is the general approach to inventory as a regulatory mechanism, and that the top-down measurements that have been made on emissions are not rectified with, or, you know, it takes some work to rectify them. The inventory method doesn't generally, comes up low, significantly low. And, you know, there's just been a lot written and done on that topic, and I think struggling, I sort of reserve the right, we said in December, could we change the question? I think that we were told yes. And so the answer might not be a cap, but the answer might be that it would be a good idea for this board to start thinking about how to incorporate top-down measurements in the regulatory regime in order to account for the fact that exposures to toxics, if you like, or the total amount of CO2 or greenhouse gases that are being produced, probably mainly methane is the issue here, are different than what the inventory method has done. And what the community would care about, I think, is what they're being exposed to and how much total is being emitted. So if the current regulatory mechanisms are not accounting for that, I think then maybe the question is, how should you best deal with that? I mean, so you fly an airplane over and it shows that you're getting a lot more emissions than your inventory thinks you have, then what do you do? Yeah. How do you deal with it? And I think that's really worthy of some thought because it's pretty significant.
I think you have to be really careful on what you mean by cap. I mean, it's easy to sort of oversimplify a cap and say a cap is just stop your emissions at this point and don't go any higher. For toxics, I think I mentioned it at the last meeting, but I'll mention it again. It seems to me for toxics, it isn't the tonnage of the emissions so much as it is how the sources, the larger sources of these chemicals line up with where people live,
right,
relative to prevailing winds, or in the case of a really complicated source like a refinery where you have, you know, maybe dozens of different sources, all of whom are overlapping in their impacts to produce a risk at some place that's not intuitive at all. It comes back to the comment I made earlier about public health. I mean, what I think you want to do is to make sure that you've taken care of the public health problem, and that, to me, isn't, for toxics, a cap on emissions. Certainly not a facility-wide cap on emissions because you have no guarantee that you'll reduce emissions, the right emissions at the right location. So I think it's important to keep an eye on the time scale or the spatial scale of the effect and in thinking about this. I mean, greenhouse, and the same similar thing is true for criteria pollutants. I mean, criteria pollutants, same thing. In some cases, like where you have secondary formation of photochemical pollutants, ozone, for example, it may take hours for the mix, the cook, and the sun to produce the ozone you're concerned about. So the spatial scale isn't so critical as it is for toxics. I mean, you might be able to have a bubble over a region or a bubble over the facility and make sense of that, but not to, certainly not for toxic. So I don't know quite how this where I'm going with this, actually.
Well, I think the corollary would be concentration.
It's much more complicated.
Right? The exposure, right?
I mean, it boils down to exposure, mm-hmm. and a sense that there may be some priority that's forced onto us in terms of protection of public health. Things that are most serious soonest are ones that we ought to, in fact, have developed the tools to address. That's what we do. I mean, that's what the district does. That's what those rules are intended to do. It's more of a concern, I'm sure, for all of us, if we're looking at a health effect that happens to me tomorrow, and not something that's a few decades away. Not to diminish that. Those could be very, very, very important in the long run, and they need to be addressed.
Yeah. So I just had a comment. I thought the discussion this morning was kind of interesting, thinking about absolute caps versus sort of rates and caps on rates or, you know, sort of process rates. So I'd be kind of curious to know the Barry refineries. I mean, they're of different vintages, right? And they've been modernized and refurbished countless times probably. But I'm kind of curious how our refineries compare to a benchmark, you know, best in class refinery that maybe somewhere in Asia or I don't know where. You know, how close to having best practices in our refineries are we on a global kind of basis? Because one idea, instead of putting a numeric cap, would be to say we want you to essentially have, you know, best practices and reduce their emissions through process improvements rather than saying, you know, you can't emit because, you know, the amount of material they're going to process is going to change over time, and they probably should have the freedom to do that. If we're saying an absolute cap, I don't see any way that they're not just going to process that somewhere else. But if we say we're going to insist that you have sort of best practices, but then you can process what you need to in the context of the cap and trade program as well with, you know, that having to contour that, it's something maybe to consider.
Mr. Chairman, if it'll help, I can answer Dr. Lippman's question to a little bit, and I'll ask Jim to add to my remarks. But the refineries here, as you indicated, have been regulated for literally many decades. And as a result, there have been programs put in place that require best practices. And I can think of the flaring, for example. We were one of the first entities to require that there be essentially a root cause analysis when a flaring event occurs, and such that they have to file a flare management plan to indicate what steps they'll take to prevent that flaring to occur in the future. As a result, flaring in the Bay Area refineries is significantly down. In fact, it's pretty rare now that it occurs. It's an example, though, where best practices have been put in place as a result of regulation. Jim, did you want to add to my remarks? I know that that's indicative of, I think, of a larger picture of the refineries here. Now, is there room for improvement? Absolutely. Are there older equipment that's operated by these refineries? That is true. There is, and it's a function of how they operate, and they're different depending on which one you're looking at of the five.
I think you hit it. It's many of our rules are first in the world, actually. And it doesn't matter whether you look at, we talk flares, we talk about releases from relief valves, which we control, no one else does. The leak definition of what is a leak, ours is the lowest of anywhere in the world. So there's rule after rule that you can point to that, in my mind, makes a refinery here one of the cleanest in the world.
Just one quick follow-up on that. Are they, the flaring has to be reported, are they ever allowed to vent methane under any circumstances, or do they have to flare any kind of methane release? And is there any direct venting going on?
I think CARB requires them to flare it. I think CARB requires them to flare it.
No venting.
Well, so when you take a look at a refinery, it has tens of thousands of valves and flanges and and they all basically, you can't have a leakless system. And so methane is a part of what gets emitted along with the VOC as well. So, and Dr. Long's point earlier about the fact that our inventories may be off is something that in the air pollution control world we all pretty much understand and accept, but how far off are we is the question. Because when you drive a plane or fly a plane over, it's all, some of the studies have indicated we're off by orders of magnitude. So,
yeah.
And there's many sources of methane beyond the refineries, right? There's POTWs and others that we need to have a better understanding of. But clearly, methane is going to be where we need to also focus. This district is already implements the landfill program for CARB, and we're looking to expand our methane controls as well under our climate protection strategy. We think it makes sense to then start applying some methane controls at the refineries. But we need to do that in concert with CARB. So,
I'm not sure if your question was relative to refineries or methane flaring in general for the pipeline systems that you have to work on. Those are the systems that are not allowed to just simply vent it, but either compress it and put it back down or flare it.
I keep sort of getting confused, not on the word cap, but on the word emissions. I thought we were discussing greenhouse gases, but a lot of this seems to be about criteria pollutants and toxics. And even methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, it's not clear to me whether the Air District is the right entity. It seems it's pretty clear the Air District isn't the right entity to be doing the greenhouse gas monitoring if the CARB is already in that business and is doing it on a much broader scale among more refineries and has sort of a bigger picture, too, of potentially leakage, for one thing. And so while it's clear the Air District, it's their interest and it's their goal to remove health hazard emissions, I guess it's not clear to me that greenhouse gas emissions should fall under that or should really be the expertise or should be the responsibility of the Air District.
I could see where that might be just the place to have it because their focus is for stationary sources. I mean, CARB has charter over fuels, vehicle emission standards and things like that, but local air districts have stationary sources. And this could be viewed, maybe probably should be viewed as a stationary source issue. I mean, if you wanted to regulate methane emissions, we're really good at volatile or reactive organic gases or volatile organic compounds, things that react in the air to make photochemical smog. Yeah. We haven't really counted the methane, but we could. And it's also the Air District that puts together emission inventories.
from stationary sources. And so putting the emission inventory together to include methane and other ones as well makes sense. In fact, we've done that. So maybe there's a joint role. I mean, who's going to verify that a particular emission, greenhouse gas emission reduction measure has been implemented and is still functioning? I mean, is there an enforcement issue, and should that be at the local district?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking less about enforcement than about policy. So I think on the policy level, the Air District going down this road seems like they're at a huge disadvantage relative to CARB or relative to the federal government, both because they don't see the larger picture, and particularly the within-state substitution, and because there is actually physical connection in these systems that goes outside of refineries, goes outside of their district, and so forth. And it doesn't seem, I on the enforcement, I can see there's a real synergy because you're already doing enforcement on other pollutants. But on the policy side, it seems like it's the opposite.
Could I ask, does the Bay Area Air Quality Management District regulate methane emissions at all? And under what?
Well, historically, when we've calculated ROG or VOC, we exclude methane. And that's just a historical because, so that's not to say we don't measure it. It's not to say that we don't also account for it in our inventories. So we do. When we went down a path of looking at our greenhouse gas inventories and started to assess whether we could and should be regulating in terms of greenhouse gases, we've actually identified where we can establish some methane controls at a whole host of sources. And as I indicated earlier, we would do that in concert with CARB. And so CARB, under their AB 32 scoping plan, for example, had landfill gas control, you know, enhanced landfill gas control. And so what we did is we helped inventory those gases, and then we, through an MOU, implemented that measure, and we enforce it actually on the ground for them because of really what the chair was indicating is there's an expertise associated with stationary sources that you'll find at the local districts more so than at the state. So it's a long answer to your question, Dr. Long. Sorry.
But it kind of begs the question, why not do that at refineries?
And that's what's being called upon us to do, is that they want to see us, a number of folks want to see us regulate greenhouse or methane at refineries. We've indicated back to the state that that's something we can and could do. And I think they're building it into their scoping plan.
Right, because it just seems like the GWP stuff is different than the CO2. And
can I just ask a question? When you said regulate, did you mean monitor and enforce, or did you actually mean set policy?
And that's the key question, right?
Yeah.
So we could enforce, we could inventory, but setting standards, that's the question that basically is embedded in that question that's in front of you.
But coming back to this, I mean, if this board had discussions about how to deal with methane emissions at industrial facilities such as refineries. I mean, I don't know why you would single out refineries, but I guess mainly because they're probably the largest source, but they might not be the only one to think about it. And, you know, it's pretty clear that there's orders of magnitude difference between the way it's being thought about and the way it should be thought about. And if you put some thought into how to do it, why wouldn't that be a subject of collaboration with CARB? I mean, I think having the problem right here and the local problem right here and trying to understand it right here would help to inform that that discussion. And it seems to me it's a big gap. I think Aliso Canyon is an example. Could be an example, and I'm not sure whether it's, you know, as we were sort of exploring before, is it actually their day-to-day practice, or is it actually some catastrophe, you know, some big accident that you can't predict. I suspect it's more the former, but that's just my bias. But anyway, I'm just wondering whether that, and, you know, coming back to your point, Stan, I mean, I think it's a piece of starting to think about how you would regulate based on exposures versus regulating based on emissions. You know, limiting, if you're limiting how much people can, how much an industry can put into the air, it's really different than limiting what people's exposure are. And my example is from the SB4 study, the fracking study that we just, California Council on Science and Technology just put out, which I chaired, which might be an ignominious title, but the thing that we saw in Los Angeles is that the amount of benzene that was being produced by production, oil production in Los Angeles in general was tiny and in a basin-wide spectrum, but nobody knows what the exposures are of the people who live there, and there are millions of people who live within a mile of a producing well. So, you know, there's just that exposure is the issue, and, you know, figuring out how to approach the regulation of that, I think, is pretty important. And this is of a piece. It's kind of like, what's the thing that matters, and how do you reflect that back in there?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting threads here, and I wanted to pick up on a couple of them. The first was this state versus local division of responsibility with, you know, the state taking the lead on mobile source and the local districts taking the lead on stationary. And for CO2, at least, I don't think that division is a helpful way to think about the problem going forward, because there's so much possibility for, say, electrification of the transportation sector. And then you end up moving mobile source emissions to the power plants that are generating the electricity, or, you know, maybe some renewable source. So I think we may need to, when we talk about CO2, we really, you know, that traditional way of dividing responsibilities is probably not going to be very helpful, because we need to integrate across that divide in thinking about the problem. I'm also trying to think in time scales, and I'd just like to try and get us focused on 2030. I think having discussions and even taking regulatory action for 2020, it's just not, that's sort of running around with our heads cut off, kind of. Let's take a more strategic and long-term view to where we want to be. And really where we want to be is, you know, by 2050, not just in California, but worldwide, we want to be down significantly. So I think the play for California is by 2030 to show the rest of the country and maybe elsewhere in the world what can be done. And so in that sense, you know, maybe we're willing to try things in a smaller market just for the purpose of hoping to pull the rest of the country along with us so we can get, you know, something bigger accomplished in the longer term. So I'm trying to think about that kind of time scale. I think the intermediate, not the very short time scale, 2020. And, you know, we need to, if all that happens by 2050 is California meets a target and no one else pays attention, you know, it's, as you said, it's only 1% or something of the global CO2. It's not, California can't do this alone. We've got to get more people playing in the
enterprise. Could you elaborate a little bit on your first point before you move on? That, like, why is the stationary versus mobile distinction not good for CO2? What do you see that would make us want to?
I think a lot of the solution in my mind, at least for the transportation sector, is going to be to switch over to electric or maybe fuel cell energy sources. And then it's a question of how is the electricity generated. And so you know, we have to put those two sectors together to optimize the total emissions. I don't think it makes sense to count or to regulate the two pieces separately. They have to be under one umbrella. Because the whole goal of the policy probably is to move vehicles from using petroleum to using other energy sources in the longer term. That's what's sort of motivating me to say that. I don't know if that's controversial.
I agree with the point, the technical point. I just don't see why how it plays into the local regulation versus state regulation issue.
I guess then it's a question of the approach. If we're going to use cap and trade, that seems like you'd want both sides of the house under the same cap. But if we're going, I guess you're right, if we're going to take a command and control approach and say cars need to meet this standard and refineries need to meet this standard, and we're going to go to each sector and have specific rules, you could divide the responsibilities as we have in the past. So yeah, I agree.
I didn't say anything to agree with, but that's
no,
okay.
I agree that the answer to my question depends on the approach to how you want to control CO2 emissions.
Okay.
And if it's a cap and trade approach, then I think it's appropriate to
take. Yeah, and then it sort of begs the question: does the cap and trade approach work according to Severin? It might not.
So two last points. Sorry, these are a lot of points here. I do see the refinery sector moving away from gasoline and having diesel and jet fuel as much increasing. That's already the history for the last 20 years. It's more and more, the diesel's growing rapidly. The gasoline in California is growing slowly, if at all. I see gasoline production in the state dropping between now and 2030, both because the cars will be more efficient that still use gasoline and because hopefully we'll have electrification. So, you know, I think demand for refinery products is going to shift in terms of it's going to shift to heavier products for trucks and planes. And I think probably the total production, you know, maybe they could start exporting it elsewhere, but because the refineries are here and can make fuel. But I foresee California demand slumping for gasoline because of what's coming. So probably that, you know, they may not have to do very much, if anything, if that's true, to lower the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing less fuel. On emissions, one other point was I think CO2 and NOx are probably our best pollutants in terms of the quality of our emission inventory, and we probably don't, you know, it's probably good to have aircraft flying around and do the top down for those even, but those are the ones that in my opinion work best, and some of the other pollutants like methane and VOC are, and PM, those are harder. But CO2 and NOx, I think we can do a pretty good job on those. That's my research area, is to try and do emission inventories for those sorts of pollutants. And those are the best cases. And some of the others are, methane is a much more difficult case. So it's, again, there's not one answer. I think there's a pollutant-specific answer for where the emission inventory is good, where top-down versus bottom-up has real advantages.
Good point.
By the way, I agree with your 2030 target idea. 2020 is too soon, obviously. But one of the other things that bothered me this morning a little bit, and I was trying to, maybe Severin, maybe you can help me with this. If we're talking, if the alternatives in reducing, treating greenhouse gases in refineries are to have a refinery cap, individual refinery cap, or to have it addressed in some fashion through cap and trade has to work. And cap and trade with $12.73 minimum base clearing price in the last auction isn't going to, obviously the cap isn't coming into play, as you were saying. But thinking about it in a longer term, and eventually it's bound, at least I hope it's bound to improve and get a better balance so that there is actually a market that's more functional. And so thinking about it for me in terms of something maybe 2030, it's not so far away that it's not too far away, but yet maybe maybe it's far enough away that there'll be some sort of regularization, normalization in that market. Is that unrealistic, or is the cap and trade market just simply never going to be functioning the way we hope it does?
I would very much doubt that the California cap and trade market will ever function as a sort of smoothly pricing market the way we sort of hoped, and that's what my work has shown, that we're very unlikely to end up in an equilibrium price that's not right at the floor or very, very high in a way that I think would trigger a political crisis. If you did it on a national level, I think that's less the case. And the longer run you do it, that's less the case, the longer the period. That is, the analysis through 2020 is different than through 2030. But it's hard to know how large the price response is out to 2030, because it's mostly technology, not actual, you know, just technological substitution with current technologies. And so you'd have to sort of forecast how is technology going to change as a result of a $30 price. Because to take an intermediate price like $30, which I would think is actually too low, but many people say is unacceptable, that's 30 cents a gallon at the gas pump. We're not going to really see much change in fuel economy for 30 cents a gallon at the gas pump. So I think that we're not going to see a well-functioning California-only or California-Quebec market. I hope we will see something broader than that. Frankly, given my own research, I hope we will see a tax rather than a cap-and-trade market, because I think that it gives more price certainty and is less subject to political crises than the cap-and-trade market is. And if we can sort of get to a price, as British Columbia has, and not revisit it, as Australia did, then I think we could get some real incentives out there. But I think the larger question, and the one Rob raised at the very beginning that I've been trying to get to also, which is why would the Air District do this? Why should a piece of California get into the greenhouse gas business of policy, not monitoring? I think is very tough argument to make. I think it's very hard to make the argument that we should do this because it's going to change climate change directly. I think that the argument often made as a state for California is sort of moral leadership. But I think if the state of California is already doing that, it's hard to see how the Air District is improving on that. And the third is the idea that you're going to push ahead technology. And that might be a good reason for a sub-state level entity to be doing this. But if they are, then I think we have to be really upfront. This is what we're doing. We are doing sort of what Germany is doing in solar and electricity systems. That is, making a social welfare contribution to the world. We're willing to be poorer in order to make this contribution to the world, which is what Germany is doing with their electricity system. They're raising their own costs, and we're benefiting. We're benefiting in pushing technology of solar forward in the way they run their grid and so forth, learning a lot from it. If we want to do that on a Bay Area level, then you can probably make that argument, but I think that that should be the terms of the argument, and my guess is that people aren't going to be that excited about that. What I often hear instead is this sort of generalized discussion of emissions and health effects and so forth that I think does confuse things, and I think we have to be clear if we're going to talk about greenhouse gases that that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about climate change, not local, any sort of local health risk.
Dr. Bornstein, we are the Bay Area. We can solve the planet, you see here.
I realize that wasn't entirely serious, but we do things in many areas where our intent is to move the rest of the world. And I'm okay with that as long as we're clear that that's what we're doing. We're going to raise the cost of refineries and potentially lose some economic activity and potentially some jobs and maybe disrupt the California gasoline system, which is already disrupted pretty badly. But we're doing it in order to push these refineries to develop new technologies, which I guess, thinking about Rob's comment of 2030, it's not clear making a refinery produce gasoline 5% more efficiently is really running us down the road to a 2030 solution. And it's not clear that we should invest our resources in forcing that sort of change instead of, I know battery technology is tough, but storage technology for transportation or whatever, those seem like 2030 type discussions more than making refineries X percent more efficient.
one point that I think we've already made, but just to circle back to it, is it seems like the first order of business is to make sure that the inventories are correct. In other words, you know, if we don't know how much methane these refineries are really emitting, to me, that's the most important near-term thing, is to get a handle on that and make sure their emissions are truly under the cap and they're not somehow skirting the cap because their methane emissions aren't being counted. I mean, that seems like the first thing we should do is make sure they're fully under the cap. And then going beyond that is something we could obviously keep talking about. But I'm concerned that they may be emitting a lot more methane than the inventories are.
And Dr. Lipman, it's unclear to us whether CARB will actually take methane and stick it under the cap or actually just do command and control. Because of the ubiquitous nature of the pollutant, you'll find it, as you know, everywhere. And so there's some debate and discussion, I think, going on the scoping plan as to whether what's the appropriate regulatory mechanism, whether it be as part of the cap or just a set of command and control measures that are implemented.
But, okay, that's a good point, though. So the cap, I mean, AB 32 includes, I think, 6 greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and then there's the sodium hexafluoride, a couple other more arcane ones. So AB 32 includes methane and nitrous oxide, but you're saying under cap and trade, they're really only focusing on CO2 at this point? Is that?
I'm just saying that I think the jury's still out. I think they're trying to decide whether what's the appropriate means to reduce methane, and it may be that it just could be just as efficient by having a series of prescribed technologies implemented, probably by the local districts.
We need the cookies to cook in, kick in. I'm still trying to understand what the effect of having a cap on local refineries would have on cap and trade. Would it be a complementary effect? Would it be a de minimis effect? Would it interfere in some fashion? Is there something, and I'm also wondering under cap and trade whether the same sources would be addressed, whether the same degree of reduction would occur. I'm just trying to understand the efficiency of it all. If you had a choice, would you pick one or the other, or would you say both can coexist? And I just don't know the answer to that. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think let's say we did refinery specific caps, just so there was no trade, for a moment in the 5 refineries, they would get a bit more efficient because they'd want to put a little bit more out for that cap. But once they started pushing their costs up, they'd no longer be the cost effective producers of gasoline, of CARB gasoline or anything else, and the production would come out of some other refinery. There are a lot of refineries in the world that can produce California gasoline. If they actually knew there was a demand, they could probably import it for 10 cents a gallon more than the in-state cost. And so we just push all those emissions out. It would raise California gas prices a bit at some times of the year, but 10 cents a gallon isn't going to change consumption of gasoline very much. So I think it would be slightly disruptive to the system, make it a little less efficient, possibly raise greenhouse gas emissions a little bit because of the extra transportation, possibly lower them to the extent that they actually do figure out more efficient ways to produce because of the cap. But I suspect when you crank those numbers, it's going to be very, very tiny changes either direction in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And a small but not negligible increase in costs. So to the extent that you're now producing something in a refinery in India instead of in the United States and raising the cost of that production, that's something that is going to be borne in part by consumers and will raise the price of gasoline. So it's hard to see how it works. It's hard to see how it would disrupt the cap and trade market in any way. If it wouldn't really do much to the cap and trade market, I think, either way. But it's also hard to see how it benefits the market in any way.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. It was hard for me to see that it would have a major effect one way or the other.
Is there some way that, or some risk that the refineries here would kind of work the other way, rather than, you know, essentially trading to emit more here than elsewhere, and sort of a reverse of the leakage problem? Not so much exporting, the refinery business elsewhere, but actually bringing more of it here, which would bring, certainly might be an economical advantage in some respects, and could be an environmental problem in other respects. And maybe by having a cap consistent with the state cap, just prevent, an expansion of emissions here. I don't know if that would make any sense, but
I guess my concern of that would be why should we care, or why should we think it's a bad thing? And I think we should think it's a bad thing not because of greenhouse gases, but because of all these other pollutants. And the Air District's business is those other pollutants. And I guess I would think that should be fall in the category of regulating those other pollutants, because those really are health hazards, and if they and they do, right? If these refineries want to increase their throughput and put out more NOx and ROG and so forth, their district is there and talking to them about it. And it seems like doing that directly rather than doing it through greenhouse gas policy makes more sense. Yeah. But again, I say that I say this not having heard from the parties that are advocating this yet.
Well, I was saying that.
There are more arguments.
Yeah, well, and I was trying to imagine what those arguments could be. I mean, when you think cap and trade, what you're really saying is that we're willing to let some large emitters not reduce their emissions because we're managing greenhouse gases on an economy-wide basis. People who can reduce greenhouse gas emissions the most in the least expensive fashion are the ones we want to implement those reductions first. So we're looking for economic efficiency with that kind of an approach. On the other hand, I can see where somebody who might be coming to us might say, well, wait a second, refineries are the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases in the Bay Area. They should reduce their emissions, or they should cap their emissions. I mean, that comes, and there may be other reasons why they might be suggesting that, but I think it's fair to try to think about that in terms of an underlying philosophy, kind of a policy. Are you looking to say that everyone who emits needs to reduce their emissions or needs to cap their emissions in some fashion, or are you saying I want to have economic efficiency and do this in the least, in the most cost-effective way? It ends up in the same place. I mean, it's just a question of who bears the pain.
Well, it's also a question of how much total pain there is.
Well, there'll be less pain.
The whole point of it is to
less,
do it more efficiently,
exactly,
so there's less pain.
We've got plenty of good examples of trading systems that there work. We have the acid rain trading program. We have the cross-state air pollution rule, where they're trading SO2 allowances among power plants. I mean, it's an efficient way to accomplish a goal. But again, there is that sort of underlying sense of fairness, which what do you tell someone when they come here next time and say, hey, they should reduce emissions because they're the biggest emitters in the Bay Area?
Yeah,
we need to have an answer for that.
But I think when you're talking greenhouse gas, if we were talking about ambient air pollutants, then we really are having a disproportionate local effect when this unit doesn't reduce. But when we're talking greenhouse gases, it doesn't matter where they come from. So it's not clear what
right.
the fairness source is. It's not a local constituent health effects fairness question. It might be a sort of cross-industry who bears the cost
fairness question. But we're already dealing with that at CARB through giving out free allowances. We're already offsetting this pain and that pain by essentially...
I think it's tied back very importantly to health hazard. I mean, when we have the tools in place to treat the health, any health hazard that's posed by refinery emissions, they're already regulated. The toxics emissions that they emit and their effects on public health are regulated. They're prevented from emitting amounts of criteria pollutants sufficient to cause an exceedance of the standard, a violation of the standard. So it's not as though we're ignoring that very important piece, which I think is not just very important. I think it's sort of at the core of the mission of the district is to protect the public health of people who live here in the Bay Area. So I don't mean to clutter it up, a discussion of cap and trade and this issue of refinery caps for greenhouse gases with other things, but it's hard for me to separate the two.
I admit I'm getting very confused.
Sorry.
I feel like this question that we've been asked was called into question by Richard Corey. I mean, he basically said that the public that he listened to cared about toxics. And then the question, what I kind of heard from you is, was this a way of getting at toxics? And I've always been told, I think Mary Nichols told me 3 or 4 years ago, that she thought that the air quality control regulations were actually going to do more for controlling CO2 than cap and trade. So I'm kind of like, I feel like we should talk about the question
before we start talking about the answer.
Although
you could view toxics regulations and criteria pollutants as focusing on public health and greenhouse reductions come along for the ride. Greenhouse gas reductions are focusing on the greenhouse gases and the health benefits come along for the ride.
It's
a little different.
I guess the question is we should listen to the public concerns we should have more information about what the public concern was to begin with. And because I don't really understand that this question addresses their concerns, which is fine, but then we ought to just know that and decide what we want to talk about. I personally still say that I'm not sure capping is the issue here, but controlling is maybe more the issue. And what should we do about controlling emissions? Because I think we have a poor control on certain greenhouse gas emissions, and I don't think the state is doing it either. They're certainly going to consider how to do it, but I don't think they're doing it. And we know we have a big problem. So to me, that's a whole. But the rest of this, I kind of get Severin's point. You know, they're policies out the kazoo on cap and trade and greenhouse gases, and the low carbon fuel standard too. Although I think that could actually, we should have a presentation on the low carbon fuel standard because that is also kind of complicated and has more to do with biofuel than it does maybe with some of these other concepts. So maybe there's some issues there. I don't really understand what are we trying to solve yet? So I think we need another informational meeting.
This is a good segue.
Yes.
Hey, it's 2:30. It's 2:30. We said we're going to take the last half hour here and talk about where we want to go with this.
So. Can I make just one comment to you?
Sure.
Toward the end, I have email filters, as I must as a politician. I have 1,267 emails. Most of which look very similar, asking more or less exactly that the board take action to do that. So I think if the idea is we would move toward hearing from the most scientific and thoughtful perspectives of the people that are driving this question, I think that would...
It
would help the board a lot to have you weigh in, hearing the most informed of those voices, because it's clearly the staff didn't make this up. Well, maybe they did, but mostly, right? It's come from
no,
right? No, it really has come from the environmental community. So Well, that's my comment.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think that's thinking forward to our next meeting. It seems to me that if we could hear from the people who are writing those 1,267 emails, and not all of them, but someone out of someone and anyone.
I've already done that.
Thank you. I would very much like to hear. I'd like to hear, and I don't know. There's many of the issues that are being raised that are policy related. They're the way people feel about things. Our job here is, I think, to sift through the science and try to do the best we can to identify what the major scientific issues are and to try to resolve whatever, and try to make sense out of all of that as best we can in a recommendation back to the board. But I think to hear someone from the group that has brought this issue before us, I wish they could identify somebody, perhaps, who could come and give some sort of a scientifically based presentation. And in fairness, it probably makes sense to ask somebody out of the refining community to do the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend four different speakers. Haven't been around this block a couple of times. You have representatives from the Communities for a Better Environment who have specifically been point and center, I think, on the question of, you know, mm-hmm. capping refineries. They may have been, frankly, the author of a lot of the 1,267 emails. But also, it would be good to hear from a representative from 350.org, because those two organizations have been in front of the board quite a bit. And when I say in front of the board, 50, 60, 70 people are coming to the board with this push. On the other side of the equation here, I think it makes sense to ask for a representative from the Western States Petroleum Association, and then also the California Council for Environmental and Economic Balance, who they're still here in the room, so they're hearing all of this today. And I think that would give you a pretty well-rounded set of discussions that will help you further deliberate on this issue.
How about somebody who from CARB who would explain the low carbon fuel standard to us?
Right, I got that down, and that's a good idea. And that's a whole other set of staff reporting to Richard, and we can ask him to have that as well.
Do we want to also have any input from the Energy Commission? I mean, are we interested in hearing about crude slate information, which I assume they're the right people for that?
At the trends that you were
talking about.
I think they're important.
We're going to fill up our next meeting really quickly.
I would think it might be two meetings. But I think it makes sense for the council to hear from a representative of the California Energy Commission on this crude slate point, because it is what's motivating a lot of them mm-hmm. to call for caps. There is a strong belief that there's going to be a crude slates that are going to be providing crudes here to the five refineries that will really, in their minds, causing the need to have a cap for greenhouse gases, toxics, criteria. Mm-hmm. And this debate, I know there's if you have to go back almost 6 months, 9 months to all the train traffic that was going on here in the Bay Area, that's some of that was really starting to raise a lot of concerns. But you know, should the picture change tomorrow, we could start to see those train traffics coming in again. So I think the council would benefit by having a representative from CEC on this point.
Could we take a little bit of time to think about what questions we want them to answer in these presentations? Because my sense is, for example, those people that are coming in and calling for a cap on greenhouse gases, I would really like them to address in their presentations what their goals are. What is it they're trying to achieve? Because I think a lot of times people propose means that don't necessarily lead to the ends. I should certainly like to hear what their ends, the ends they have in mind are.
Yes, and we've heard some presentations that do speak to that. So. I know that they can answer that question.
Okay.
And I'd like to know that too. I mean, I think you're right to ask that question. I'd like to have the presentations be as as focused on some of the scientific questions as possible. I mean, there's a lot of non-scientific issues that could easily consume the time that people would have to speak. And I don't know how much time, if we have four representatives coming in plus questions, if each of these people have more than, gosh, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, it's gonna be a long day for us. And these are very important voices to be heard. So I'm not trying to short circuit any of this, but I just want to try to keep it focused as much as possible, not just on what they want, that's important, but also what they see as the scientific issues that we should be wrestling with. I had sort of a sequence of meetings in mind, and I haven't run it by you, so let me just sort of outline sort of what I think is the big picture here with respect to this answering this question.
What a good chair.
It seems to me it's easy. We've had our first meeting. Now we've had our second meeting almost. Now the third meeting is going to be the public input and CEC on the crude slate issue and the LCA, the
life cycle
analysis stuff. That's a lot. Then we've had a lot of input. We've heard from ARB about cap and trade. Well, we've heard from the district about their regulation of refineries here. We will have heard from CEC and additional ARB people, and particularly the people who are stakeholders in all of this. Seems to me at that point we're kind of at a point where we ought to start trying to put some pieces together and see where we net out on this stuff. So I'm thinking in terms of a fourth meeting, and that fourth meeting is where we begin to try to put it together and whether we need to go. And if you think about 3 months in between meetings as sort of a rough schedule for this, I mean, I know there might have been fears based on the last meeting that we were going to accelerate that meeting schedule, and perhaps we may still, but for now, I think 3 months makes sense. The next meeting would be 3 months from now, May, something like that. Is that right? And then the fourth meeting would be September.
So if I could, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would suggest you maybe have one meeting for the four speakers and then have another meeting after that for the LCSF and CEC presentations, because I think those are fairly meaty presentations for you to mull over, and then maybe a meeting after that. So it would be your fifth meeting is where you would potentially have recommendations.
We just want to be sure we're timely in getting you back information. And so it's your needs, I think, that dictate the schedule. If we can do a fifth meeting, that'd be great.
Right.
That would take us to November.
I think that'll still be timely for the regulatory decisions that the board needs to make.
Okay.
I would just ask that we try to schedule them as soon as possible. I don't want to miss another one.
That's a very good suggestion. Okay. All right.
So
yeah.
I want to make sure that, I mean, for us to spend five meetings on this issue is a significant investment of council time. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that, you know, this issue is preeminent and worthwhile from the agency's point of view. There are other issues we could help you with, but if this is what you want us to help you with, we can focus on that. But I just want to observe, I think that we're making a fairly substantial commitment to talking about this issue. And if there's other burning issues on the agenda, I just want to raise that question to make sure we're not spending too much time on one issue when there's a lot of other questions at hand as well.
You're offering to multitask.
No, I'm just commenting that spending five meetings on this issue is a lot of effort. And if that effort is needed, you know, I'm certainly willing to do it. I'm actually excited about the topic, so it's not there's no hesitation on my side. I just want to make sure that you know, our sponsors here, if I could call you that, are on board with that kind of investment of council effort on this one issue.
Dr. Harley, I can just tell you, I would say definitively yes. It's worth your time. It's certainly worth our time for you all to come to a deliberative set of recommendations for the board. It is. We have been struggling with the issue that's in front of you for Director Sinks for more than a year, and it's there's an anticipation that we will come to some resolution of this point, and that's namely the district's stepping into for greenhouse gas reductions on the largest sources here in the Bay Area by the end of the year. And so I think it needs to be done in a thoughtful manner, and I think I can't think of a better group of folks to advise the board on this. So my
only question is, if we are going to try to do this, I think the board's interest would be in trying to conclude it in this year, so that perhaps the board could study your findings and make recommendations. Mm-hmm. If it goes out too far, then some frustration builds up that why is it taking so long? And so that's the only comment I would make.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to make a suggestion to you that you meet every other month.
Meet
every other month to speed it up a little bit on the point that Director Sinks is making.
You know, if we think it's going to take that many meetings to come to an informed opinion, then...
The other issue is that when you get to the summer, it gets hard to schedule in some ways because people go on vacation. I mean, I would rather have a few more meetings in the spring, and I'd like to get the data collection stuff over with and not wait in between too long, as we kind of forget what happened last time.
I'm happy with doing it every other month or working it out in some fashion where we take advantage of non-vacation periods. I know you're all pretty busy people, and exceptionally busy, as a matter of fact, so I don't want to impose on your schedule more than we already are. If we were to go every other month, does that create trouble?
On the dates.
It just depends on the dates.
Yeah. Or?
Generous.
Nominally trying to do a meeting, say, in April, and then another one maybe around early, mid-June, and then take a break for July, August, and then try to have that fifth meeting around September. That might work, that kind of schedule. Something like that would work well for me. Seems like it would. We try to get some recommendations to the board, in the fall rather than end of the year.
All right.
And then we might make the end of the year.
Yeah, it occurs to me that we haven't yet decided how we're going to assemble our recommendation, what it will look like, and who's going to do it. I mean, we've talked about staff preparing it for us and us reviewing it, but I don't know that we've reached a decision on that.
Mr. Chairman, we still stand ready to prepare it for you, but you would edit, review, and mark up as you see needed.
Right. And we've seen in the past with the prior incarnation of the Advisory Council that sometimes it can take a while to work through the wording of a report. And I think we're hoping to sort of avoid some of that by asking staff to at least get an initial draft that we can use and mark up.
Yeah.
With the understanding, of course, that anybody who eventually wishes to here can put their own statement on it. Uh-huh. I'll lock KSAC the way they do it. Yeah, if you want to, that's fine.
Dissenting opinion.
Or concurring opinion and then elaborating on that in some fashion. However you want to do it is fine. All right. So we'll look to every other meeting for a while. And so instead of May for our next meeting, are we looking at April? And then June, and then off for summer, and then September back? That seem reasonable? And we'll aim at 5, and the next meeting then?
June is awful. Just awful, because the academic year ends, and so everybody puts every meeting they can put. I don't think I have a single day in June already.
But everyone's perfectly available in July.
No.
Maybe try to crowd two before the end.
I think, yeah.
Well,
whatever.
I guess there is also the possibility of cramming more in and taking more time when we're here. We did it this morning, starting at 10 and going till 3.
Yeah.
We could add
that. Despite the fact that I think there's an argument for not
Just do a long day.
Just a long day. I know, Mike, I think I know you were flying up. You're doing the commute from L.A. today.
I mean, this eats up the day anyway. You know.
You can be here by 10. If we start at 10, you can make it. But if we can, yeah.
But, yeah, if we're going to have,
Yeah, there's a limit to how my attention will waver after a long session, I suppose. And I'm with four groups coming in next time to talk. I don't know how attentive I will be to listen to a nice detailed presentation on crude slates, but we could schedule it. How do you feel about that?
So Stan, so I understand your proposal would be to have one meeting similar format to today and maybe have four speakers in the morning and two in the afternoon and get all the info sessions on one day.
Yeah.
I'm up.
I mean, I'll just get two cups of coffee and one in each hand and I'm ready to go.
With scotch in one hand.
I mean, I'd rather do that than, I appreciate that there's an urgency to what we're doing. I mean, the board isn't going to wait forever. Staff needs our input, and the sooner we can get to a point where we can start to frame that, even if we haven't done the final report, at least if we've begun to sort of see, maybe we test what we agree on, and sort of clarify what the points, if we can, that we agree on, and maybe some things where we don't, because it may be that we don't end up agreeing on everything, and this may not be a yes-no kind of question. It may be something that's more nuanced. All right, okay. So what that means is one meeting maybe in April with the four groups plus CEC.
That sounds good.
Is that okay?
And Mr. Chairman, we'll poll for you for a date.
Okay.
Don't worry about that.
Okay.
Good.
All right. The low carbon fuel standard dropped off then?
No, I just forgot. Okay. See, that's what happens when, toward the end of the day, the caffeine is not kicking in anymore. Certainly the LCA, for sure. Low carbon fuel standards.
Just a friendly amendment. If we could ask for a presentation on the low carbon fuel standard, but, I think one of the things that happens is then you get a presentation on the standard itself, but we would maybe like them to address how they expect the low carbon fuel standard to affect refinery performance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think of a specific question because.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Rather than the upstream part of the. Not focusing so much on the upstream part of the process. Then.
You mean that which reservoirs are being tapped? Yeah. Well, I mean, our question is the refinery, so they're not unlinked, right?
It's all in the same umbrella.
Yeah. Right? So I would say, how is it going to affect the fossil fuel supply? Because basically, if they push the low carbon fuel standard in certain ways, or what other policies they have that would change that they're thinking of, that would change what upstream oil comes into the refineries in California. I think that would be relevant too. I mean, if they make it harder for heavy sour oil to come into California for refining, then maybe we get more activity like what's happening at Shell, where they leave off their coker, and then because it's that much more expensive for them to refine it, it's not just the expense of refining, but the added expense that the state has placed a burden on them. If there's anything like that, I think that's relevant.
We have a couple of quick items on our agenda here. We had 2 points at our meeting for public comment. The first was on agenda matters, and we dealt with that at the outset of the meeting. At this point, I'd also like to invite any member of the public who has something on non-agenda items. If they wish to address us, you're welcome to do that. Okay. Next is the comments, other business council members. And if you have anything you want to say on any matter, you're welcome to say it. So the time and place of our next meeting to be determined, but likely April.
Okay.
Pending everyone's calendar check. Thank you. Thank you very much. If that's it, then thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure again. Thank you, everybody out there. And thank you, everyone who's on the web. We're done.